This episode is brought to you by DistroKid.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hey, everybody. Today's guest is Brian Baker from Dag Nasty, Bad Religion, also played in Minor Threat, plays in the Beach Rats. He's played with Junkyard, been in a ton of bands, and he's been amazing in all of them. I love Brian's style, and I love him as a person, and you know, he's one of those guys that that paved the way for people such as myself to be in a punk rock band and have a quote-unquote career at it. Brian picked the Dag Nasty classic, Can I Say, to discuss today. Brian talks about how in the early days, everyone got writing credit on all the songs. He talked about how a lyric like I defended what I should have denied is very much his style of lyric. Dag Nasty, this is interesting. They recorded the entire album twice. I'd love to hear the first take on that. Brian remembers sitting on his futon on the floor of a group house playing the guitar and coming up with the guitar parts of Can I Say. Brian did not think that they were making songs that would have been revered 30 years later. Getting a real job was absolutely unacceptable for Brian. He had to figure out how to make being in a band work. He talked about how not a lot of artists were writing the socially conscious type of lyrics that Dag Nasty was writing in the 80s. Punk rock was still very much protest music. And we talked about how fanzines were the original analog podcasts. And I give a shout out to my friend Bill Weaver. He was the first guy back in high school to play me Dag Nasty, and I loved him from the first time I heard him. For all this and much more, stay tuned.
Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast. Hey, hey, have you heard? Krista makes a podcast.
Brian, of course, started out in Minor Threat and then moved on to Dag Nasty, formed in 1985. And Brian picked the song Can I Say. Tell us about this one, Brian. You know, when I did a little research on it, I noticed that it's the writing credits were attributed to everyone in Dag Nasty. So did you have a hand in writing this one, or Dave, or who put this one together?
Well, you know, way back in the 20th century, when everything was in black and white and you were in one band, what you did is you credited the whole band for everything.
Right.
So in some cases, that works out well for me, like saying, you know, that Ian MacKay, who wrote 98% of the lyrics for Minor Threat, you know, when it comes to, you know, splitting up that T-shirt money, it's the same, even for the little bass player who basically did very little.
But there was no money back in the 80s, so no one really gave a shit either, right?
You know what's funny? But take this. That's how we split up Beach Rats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good for you.
That's just what you do. I mean, it's really, I don't know. It's the constant argument. Are you going to be democratic, socialist, or communist, using the most limited definitions, the dumb guy definitions of all three of those systems.
And right,
for the most part, there's been, you know, communism was the way to split up shit. But I pick Can I Say because I did write the music, and Sean wrote a lot of the words. I think in that day when we were that little, everyone kind of just gathered around a notepad. Like Sean would have, you know, some words, and then Roger would go, why don't you change that word from disagree to fuck you? Oh, that's better. That's stronger. Good, Raj. And looking at Can I Say, I texted Sean. I was like, what did you write? And he goes, I think I wrote everything, but I'm not sure. And And I looked at the lyrics to Can I Say, and there's a couplet that says, I defended what I should have denied. And that's straight up Baker right there. That's that's so like, you know, armchair.
Armchair Brian.
Yeah. But so it's really, I mean, I think Sean wrote most of it, but I see some edit in the lyrical portion of it. But the music I had, and it the reason I picked it, is I think the first or second Dag Nasty song that I had written and brought in. So it's very early. I don't remember which was, I don't know if it was first or not.
Right.
And in just spending a little time analyzing it, I just noticed, you know, I can kind of, now I can go back and see where I got, you know, where I stole from and how it all worked out. So it's kind of an interesting thing to look at.
Well, you know, it's amazing to me that you know, and a lot of times when you're talking about songwriting, I like to talk about the production because it really lends itself. You know, some songs possibly could have been quote unquote hits, but the production sound like crap. For 1986, I mean, this recording, I mean, it's leaps and bounds above what else was going on. And the bands that I love from that era, even Descendants, I mean, this record sounds so friggin' good, recorded analog. Do you remember much about the recording process and what Ian brought to the table producing-wise?
Well, sure. I mean, it was exactly the same equipment and the same, if I'm not mistaken, I think it was, you know, God, I should probably know this. There's a chance that this is a 16-track recording.
Right.
And that might have something. I would have to call Don because he would know.
Because I have the original disc, not remastered. I mean, this is the original thing. And yeah. No one sounded like this in 86. I mean, I didn't hear a Dag Nasty till probably I was 15 in 88. So 88 or 89. And I was playing baseball. And we used to drive to the baseball games on the school bus. And my friend Bill Weaver, he had this Walkman, and he's like, "Dude, check this out!" And it was Wig Out of Denko's, and it was the first time I'd ever heard you guys. And I was just so struck by it because I lived in this little town. It was a oppressive little town in Florida. Our record store was the Camelot in the mall. It was, you know, we had nothing. You had to go drive 2 hours to Tampa to see a show. And, you know what was going on in the late '80s. Nothing sounded like this. And to go back now, 30 plus years later, and to listen to it with fresh ears, it's amazing how not blowing smoke up your ass, man. It's just it sounds so friggin' good and clean. I mean, that I got lost in a lot of the stuff that my friends were getting in quote unquote punk. It just, okay, it's out of time, it's out of tune, and someone's screaming. That sucks. Right. Like I loved stuff with melody, and you know, it just sounds amazing. So. Do you remember like how long it took to record? Was it a couple days?
Well, the only reason I was trying to figure out if it was 16 or 8 is because I know Out of Step was the first 8-track recording at Inner Ear. We were like the test. We were the guinea pigs,
right?
For him getting that that machine, and I was just trying to see if maybe the Dag Nasty record, if anything had changed in Don's studio. That would have contributed to that, but I think it's probably just experience that, you know, this is a recording that was done a couple of years later and you just get better at it. And, you know, Don and Ian know what they're doing and they have, you know, there's so many Discord records that just sound different and better, in my opinion, than their contemporaries. In recording Dag Nasty, I don't remember specifically what happened, but I've done a lot of records with Don and Ian, and my guess is this. We recorded it all in one day, and then we mixed it in another day. Would seem like what we would do at that time. Possibly 2 days of recording, because I know this record, we had demoed basically we had made the entire record with Sean Brown, and when we got Dave to sing, we redid the record. And so we may have paid more attention to, like, we may have taken a little extra time.
So how rehearsed were you guys? Because again, I mean, there's no Pro Tools here. There's no fixing shit. I mean, you guys, it's no. Tight.
Well, we were totally rehearsed. I had a pretty, pretty serious work ethic. And so did the other guys. I mean, we wanted to be, we want it to be really good. And there's just a style. I don't know. It's just kind of the DC thing. Like, we rehearsed constantly. We wanted to be prepared for this thing. Dag Nasty was a point in my life where I wanted to put together a band so I could get out of Washington and actually tour in other cities. And I never got to other countries. I think that that time going to another country was still this impossible, like, walled off fantasy.
Right.
You know, you never realized that you could actually, I don't know, why don't you just fly to London? Like, no one ever thought about it. Dumbasses.
Well, no, I mean, just think about, God, it's so hard to think back then, but you couldn't check out London with a click of the button at a computer. It was a foreign world. It was
right.
There was fear.
But it's just funny, like, when you go and you find, I mean, not to get on a tangent, but there were bands who are contemporaries of Dag Nasty who, one of those band members went, well, I don't know, why don't I just call and see if I can find a promoter in Helsinki? And then they called somebody in Finland who answered the phone and spoke perfect English and said, well, yeah, you know, if you guys can, you know, take Finnair and come into Helsinki, we can do two shows. We just never even thought about it. We're so dumb. I really wish. But that aside, back to what you're hearing with this record. The guitar sound, I wasn't into, unfortunately, I was pretty into chorus pedals. Which is, can I say, I think has a chorus pedal that I never turned off the whole time.
That's funny. I don't really hear that.
I was very into this MXR chorus, that this yellow box that plugged into the wall had four knobs on it. And it's now like kind of a collectible piece and gear nerds are really into it, but it's incredibly dirty. Like, it's not a, you know, at the time we didn't realize that it had a lot of whoosh to it, even
right.
Standby. But, you know, I was playing a Les Paul through a stock Marshall through a 412 with a chorus pedal. And so there wasn't a lot of discharge guitar sound. You know, there wasn't a lot of that early punk that's a little chaotic. There's tube screamers. There's just MXR distortion. There's just, you know.
Yeah, crate amps.
We had really good equipment because it was important to us to have good equipment. And, you know, Roger went and bought a P bass, and we had an SVT and a Galen Kruger head, because that's what you had in 1985. Because that's what the Descendants had, and everyone wanted to be the Descendants. You know, it was like, you look at, well, who's pro? The Descendants.
Right. Well, I feel like, you know, whether unfairly or not, that the Dag Nasty just gets so overlooked. You know, of course, you hear Minor Threat, you hear Black Flag, you hear Descendants from that time period. But Dag Nasty and the sound of, you know, especially, can I say, just this record in general, to me, and I love all the aforementioned bands, it's just leaps and bounds. There's something special about it. It's just tight. It's clean. The guitars are clean and it's unmistakably you, you know, your style. When you go to the lead parts, you can just tell, I can tell it's Brian Baker, and that's really cool. So going back to this song in particular, you know, you remember creating it? Do you remember like coming up with the chords and what was that thought process like, if you could take us back?
I believe I was living in my first, I think it was right when we moved into, me and a bunch of friends moved into a group house in Arlington that was like maybe 10 blocks from Discord House. And Arlington is just across the bridge from DC. Like, I mean, you know, it's when people, you know, in the historic DC that everybody talks about, and everyone talks about the old 930 Club. I lived closer to the 930 Club living in Virginia than I did where I grew up in DC proper. So it was really, you know, this was a, like a little suburb that was very working class, and they would rent a big beat up house to a bunch of lunatics with motorcycles and bleached hair with an unhealthy obsession with Mad Max. You know, it was like, and I think I really, when I'm looking back and seeing it, I think I remember just like sitting on my futon, of course, on the floor of the room and smelling the fresh paint that was a color that was available because someone made a mistake.
Vomit pink.
Yeah, or whatever's there. Ooh, that'll be weird. children. And yeah, I just had, I mean, I know that I had, the intro and the, which is actually the breakdown in the intro, because the intro definitely had to have been me being very into Discharge. I think I just really remember coming up with that kind of that repetitive Blur intro. And then the breakdown is just that, is just a stylized version of that, at halftime. And right then, that's half the battle, that you have the attention getter that starts the song, and you have the breakdown, which is absolutely necessary if you're going to participate in American punk rock music in the 80s.
Yeah, you needed the mosh part.
You needed the mosh part, for sure. And it's not even so much the dancing for me. It was just like, that's the release of the song. There's all this tension, and then this release comes from when you get down to something kind of halftimey or something at a slower tempo, which I love. I mean, I'm a sucker for that, and it's such a great tool.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Did and you... that you know what that one that act right there just refined itself into Quiet Loud, and that you know that is definitely that American tradition of doing that kind of songwriting is reflected in a more refined version in Nirvana and their subsequent success. I mean,
sure. Yeah. The Pixies, Nirvana, that was what their careers were built on. Quiet Loud.
Yeah. And great, because it's a great idea and they both made really great music. So I'm a fan of how everything worked out.
Sure. But, so, you know, it's almost hard to talk about some of this stuff with you. You know, you're a hero of mine that became my friend. And I mean that with all my heart. And it's like, I just, did you have any forethought, Brian, when you were doing this record of that, the influence, not just this record, Minor Threat, just, you know, all those early projects, the influence that it would have? I mean, dude, you guys paved the road. By the time Less Than Jake started touring, 92, 93, the roadblock was gone. The road was open for us to do what we were doing. And that's because of the bands that did it in the 80s. I mean, there was no rule book. There was no playbook back then. You guys were flying by the seat of your pants. Did you ever think that you were making songs that would be revered 35 years later?
Oh, absolutely not. Not even a question. And I think that's probably why they, you know, in some cases that lack of expectation, I think, makes something, gives it longevity. I mean, 100% certainly in Minor Threat, this was a high school band for me, and I had no idea that it would become a relatively significant part of like the American, you know, alternative music songbook. I didn't know. We were, you know, not looking beyond, you know, the next couple of months, and we didn't really think it was that precious, which I think has, you know, I mean, we broke up a couple times. It's you certainly, the interpersonal relationships of the band members were far more important than the music, you know, when you think about it, because why would you break up something like that as well? Because we, you know, we were teenagers, or at least a couple of us were, and we didn't know how to be in a band yet.
Right.
And, you know, that was the thing. And there's a little different thing to Dag Nasty, though, is that when I did Dag Nasty, it was after I had been in Minor Threat and we broke up, and I was going to pretend to go to college, and that was unsuccessful. And I was playing in the Meat Men with my friend Tesco as kind of like a temp.
Yeah. I've read about that before. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause he is funny, and he lived in DC at the time. And I, had a couple projects that started and it just really kind of fizzled out. And I wasn't really, but the thing mainly was that I wasn't really paying attention to music. Music after Minor Threat, it was something I did, but I also was a motorcycle courier, and I was into, you know, motorcycle tracks and all the, it's hard to describe, but it just didn't become a priority. And with Dag Nasty, that was in a conscious attempt. I don't know if I just woke up one day, but I said, you know what, I need to get a real band started, and I need to get out and see the world, or I'm just going to wind up, you know, fucking around and getting a job. And that's absolutely not acceptable.
In any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. And it wasn't that I thought that Dag Nasty could like monetize an empire. The point was, I needed to be doing something. I needed to do something creative. And I loved playing music, and I love playing music live. And everything, you know, the touring and all of the things that go with it are equally as important to me. As far, you know, the experience of doing it is so beautiful to me. And so in Dag Nasty, I'm like, I should do a band. I need to play punk music because I know how. And I need to put a band together that people who liked Minor Threat and Government Issue and The Descendants would like, because these are bands that I like. Like, it wasn't, I wasn't trying to build a, like a copy machine. I was just like, look, I got to get my, I have to get myself aligned on what is it that I want to do. And I want to play music like this. And I need to find people who agree, who want to do it too.
Well, and it's just, again, it is amazing to me. You know, you got to think back to the 80s, and that was my decade. That's when I was growing up as a teenager. And back then, I mean, you know, you either ran with the pack and you sounded like everybody else and you formed a metal band or a dance band or new wave, or you went against the grain and you were this punk band. Well, you know, going against the grain in 92, 93, 94, when Less Than Jake was starting out, you know, punk was just this massive thing, especially when Green Day and Offspring and all that hit, you know. And again, yeah, the road was already paved with you guys. But back in the 80s, you were going to either follow the herd and be in some pop or metal band or some new wave band, or you're going to go against the grain and be a punk rocker and do what you guys were doing. You know, by the time, Less Than Jake was getting going, 92, 93, 94, the road was already paved. And then you had, you know, the Green Day and the Offspring and all that take off. And it was like this thing, like you could be part of it and it wasn't weird. Being in a punk band in the 80s was weird. I mean, you were looked down at. And here you are writing these, you know, from Minor Threat and even into Dag Nasty, these socially conscious lyrics. Nobody was writing this stuff. I say nobody, very few bands. You know, yeah, you look at these lyrics. What can I say? Why should I try? I tried to love what I knew I hated. I took a lie and I made a truth. I defended what I should have denied. I mean, where was this coming from? I mean, I know you mentioned Government Issue, Discharge. Of course, you know, you were in Minor Threat, but where were these feelings coming from?
Well, I think that the key is that punk rock at that time was still protest music. And this is, and also sort of like, you know, there's a little bit of like self-help, a little therapy going on here. This is a purging. And this was the norm. It wasn't weird that you would have lyrics that, you know, I mean, in looking at these lyrics, I'm sure that there were specific incidents that triggered some of the language. But in general, you know, we were in the business of trying to figure out what the fuck is making the world go around and why are people the way they are. And this is a little different than, you know, that's a cute girl or what are you doing on Saturday night? And it's just sort of built into that hardcore punk ethic. And this is just, you know, I think that history shows that the DC protests music was a little bit more about interpersonal, you know, personal politics and interaction with peer groups rather than protesting a system or, it didn't really have a lot of global significance in it, like in that sort of sense. Mm-hmm. So Dag Nasty, these lyrics are kind of in keeping with what everybody was doing then. It was just a natural thing. I mean, realize that we're contemporaries of Rites of Spring at this point.
Like, oh, right.
Dag Nasty, Rites of Spring, Beefeater, Embrace. We all played shows together. And, you know, for honestly, Dag Nasty were like the jocks compared to those guys.
Well, yeah. I mean, you guys were definitely had more of a pop sense than someone like Embrace. You know, there was a little bit more melody.
Well, but also there was fast songs still. Mm-hmm. Dag Nasty still went doopa doopa da doopa doopa da doopa doopa da. Like they, you know, we had not that basic early hardcore beat is still half that Can I Say record.
Mm-hmm.
So it was more, I don't know. We weren't quite as esoteric as those guys musically. But that lyrical bent is, it really kind of just a product of what was happening there. It wouldn't occur to me to write music about smashing the state or getting fucked up at that point, you know,
right.
just wasn't it.
So back around this time, you know, there was very few outlets. I mean, you had Maximum Rock and Roll and Flipside, but like, do you remember like the initial reviews and what people thought of it? I mean, this was at the time, a new project.
You know, I don't really know. I don't really remember because there were so few outlets. I mean, there were
right.
There were a lot more fanzines at that point. By 85, there was a lot of fanzine culture was really pretty up there. And,
sure.
you know, I mean, just to take a guess, I'm sure Maximum and Rock and Roll hated it. And I bet Flipside thought it was good. and all of the other, I mean, I know that we had, that people liked it in DC, that we had we built a pretty big following really quickly, and people really seemed to enjoy the band. And that's awesome. I'm totally grateful.
Looking to elevate your music career? DistroKid is a digital music distribution service that enables musicians to distribute their music to online stores and streaming platforms such as Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube Music, Amazon, Tidal, and many more. DistroKid collects earnings and payments, sending them to you, the artist. With DistroKid, artists unlock a world of possibilities, from easily paying collaborators with splits to securing your music with DistroLock. DistroKid covers all bases. Plus, you can promote your releases with HyperFollow and create eye-catching visuals with a Spotify Canvas generator, all for free. But that's not all. Introducing the DistroKid app, now available on iOS and Android. Artists can manage their releases, view streaming stats, and withdraw earnings, all from the palm of their hand. And for those looking to perfect their sound, check out Mixia. With its simple interface and customizable mastering options, artists can make their music sound polished and professional within minutes. And don't forget about Instant Share, DistroKid's newest feature. Share large files securely with collaborators, producers, and more, ensuring your music streams at the highest quality. Ready to take your music to the next level? Download the DistroKid app and explore their suite of tools today. Plus, listeners can enjoy 30% off their first year by visiting distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. That's distrokid.com/VIP/demakes. Right. I mean, you know, looking back, you had mentioned like fanzines. I mean, those were the original, those were analog blogs and analog podcasts. And by that time, I think I first saw my first fanzine probably a little later than that, like I said, probably when I was 88 or 89. And I was amazed by it that someone could create something in their bedroom. And a lot of it was copying, pasting stuff out of Maximum Rock and Roll and Flipside because they didn't have any content.
Yeah, for sure. I remember. I mean, fanzine, it was really prevalent, actually. I mean, that's this, you know, we start out with Maximum Rock and Roll, and you know, I remember when I was first reading that, and I'm assuming that came out in 81 was when Tim started that magazine, though I could be wrong. But the whole thing for me was the scene reports where they had, like, you know, satellite journalists in Salt Lake or in Detroit, and it was all coming into this Maximum Rock and Roll that was a big portion of the magazine, is this sort of, and internationally, of course, too.
Right.
The other people who weren't afraid to use a telephone to call Norway.
At $8 a minute.
Yeah, but you know what? So what? You get 2 minutes. It's what's $16 going to buy you now? That's what I ask you.
Yeah, not much.
But that is then all of those scene reports turned into their own magazines. That's what was really cool. Like you collected them on tour, and that was a big thing. Like I still have, I have a fraction of the Minor Threat ephemera that I had collected over the years, just due to, you know, loss of work, sales.
Yeah.
I don't really have a complete library, but I do still have, I always picked up fanzines in every city that we played. And so I have, you know, these yellowed, you know, something from Raleigh, North Carolina, or the Gainesville, the Roach Motel guy did something. And, sure. you know, it was kind of as an almost an equal partner to the music, to the releases, and a whole culture of itself, in and of itself.
So take us back to those years. You know, you put out a few records in the 80s with Dag Nasty, and what kind of, and I don't want to get into the breakup or this and that, but why do you think that it fizzled out? Because I think you guys were just such a fantastic band, and just to hear the influences. I mean, the other day, on Shuffle, some Propaganda song came out, and I'm like, okay, they lifted that one from the Dag Nasty playbook. It's just blatant. I mean, it just sounds so much like, and there's so many other bands that have not only cited you as influences, but you can hear it in their music. And, why do you think that it just didn't resonate like some of the other contemporaries from that time period that are still out
well,
there?
Well, I think that there's a number of reasons. One, constant lineup changes. And, you know, having three singers is confusing. Two, we didn't know we were doing anything important. So it's not like I had like, okay, I've refined this new sound that I'm going to make, you know, and then I'm going to thread this through subsequent releases. Dag Nasty, all three records are very different from each other. They all have different people on them. The last record is the least good. So that doesn't help your legacy when you go from a high point and continue to go down.
Sure.
And whether that's true or not, that's the perception. Mm-hmm. I think that there's strengths on all the records, but I will agree that Field Day, Field Day is a record written by, I had just discovered pot, and I lived on the beach in Hermosa Beach in LA. And like, what kind of angst comes from that gentle, bleached-haired, fucking tan stoner kid who's in his early 20s, who's never been to, you know, living at the beach. I mean, oh God, life is tough.
Yeah.
the songs are, I will say I'm still guilty of this, is that most of the songs I write sound like songs that I like already, or styles of music that I get into. It's like Dag Nasty, I was just, at that point, I was really into, I had just discovered stuff Stone people like.
Uh-huh.
Because I'd never been stoned before.
Right.
So, like, hey man, Robert Cray's a serious blues man. It's like, well, yeah. No, you more on this. Like, that's like being into John Mayer, you know. But
yeah.
At the time, I like, oh man, this is cool. I love Strats. I just, and no one, you know, because there was no, there were no stakes. There was no, you know, we weren't really doing it. We were just going along. I don't know. Carrying on is a phrase they say a lot in New Jersey. Now, like, well, just carrying on.
Yeah, well, I mean, if someone tried to play you Robert Cray when you were living in the pink vomit house in D.C., you would have told them to fuck off. I mean, yeah.
No, of course not. I would have told them to fuck off. And there's so much. In retrospect, there's so much learning I could have used. Like, so much. But I was just doing it, you know?
Right. Well, hey,
Chris, you might know this one. Another thing about being a musician is not wanting to do the least possible to have shelter. Like, I will do the very least I can do to open myself up for all this free time where I'm going to do nothing. I mean, there's a laziness to being a musician that can't be denied.
Absolutely. Although, and I don't know, I want to see how you feel about this. I feel like it was definitely way worse when I was younger. I feel like as time goes by, I look at time a little more precious and I try to make better use of my time. Do you find that, or are you getting less, more complacent?
Oh, no. Now I'm it's DEFCON 1. I'm just I'm 100% focused on this. And now I have a legacy to burnish. So,
I'm right. Well, yeah. And yeah, I can relate to that. It's just, you know, you want to build on what you have. And for me, I don't want to lose it.
I want everything I do to be worthwhile. And I work really hard at that. And I don't want, you know, the time has passed, long past, for clunkers. And, you know, it's now, somehow I've kind of refined what I do into a style that is recognizable. And it's about working on that and seeing what I can do with that. Oh, you know, it's a whole different mission statement now, because now I actually make a living playing music, and I have done so for decades. And so I know that to be, you know, even mildly successful, you can't just be lazy. It's real work. And I treat it as such now because I'm, you know, I'm a grown up and I'm sober and I don't, you know, and I don't like Robert Cray anymore.
They took your pot away and you can't listen to it.
You know, like what was, I didn't even know. All I had to do was like read one book about the Rolling Stones and I would have figured out exactly what was going on. But
yeah,
you know,
well, it's amazing to think now, because I remember when you first joined Bad Religion, and it seems like yesterday, but my God, it was 27 years ago now, huh?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, that's just unreal. And to think that your tenure in that band eclipses pretty much the rest of the tenures of all of your bands is remarkable.
What can I say? It's a great job.
Yeah, yeah.
And
well,
I like working there, and I really love I love the people I work with. So
good for you. That is awesome. I got a couple of things I just want to discuss here, and I'll let you get on with your day. Over the years, starting back to even when you were a kid, and do you know when you hear a song, any song, like, do you know immediately that it's a hit, or does this, do you have to hear it a few times? Does it have to grow on you and be like, that's a hit, or that's going to be a hit?
I know it instantly.
Right.
When you're talking about listening to other people's songs.
Yeah. Other people's stuff. Yeah. Like I always use the example of Smells Like Teen Spirit. I remember being in college my first semester and this dude played it for me, and I was just like, immediately, I'm like, this is massive. This is a hit song. It has every ingredient for a hit song. Like you know that when you hear it. Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I might be a little, with really modern stuff that doesn't have guitars in it. Like, mm-hmm. I am not a student of this, of what's currently very, very popular with people. And I can't tell if I could listen to a mumble rap song and know if it was a hit or not.
Completely agreed. I'm still talking in the, yeah. And there's even some avant-garde post-punk weird stuff that ends up, you know, maybe being a hit that I'm like, I don't get that. And so, yeah, I understand. I guess I'm speaking from a standpoint of anything that's in the realm of a rock, even a pop song, like, you know, as much as I'm not going to put on the next Taylor Swift record anytime soon, no offense. But you listen to some of those songs, you're like, okay, that screams hit.
For sure. If we're talking about, if the caveat is we're dealing with, you know, guitar based, familiar orchestration, I mean, Taylor Swift certainly counts in that as mm-hmm. well as does, you know, as Discharge. I mean, that's still basically the same tools. I can definitely, know if something is in my a hit because of, it's like, I can't listen to music without listening to how it's made anymore.
Right. Yes. Yes.
And when I'm hearing stuff, it's like, and something comes around, I'm like, oh boy, was that smart. Yeah. I love that. And I'm never just sitting back and listening to music. I'm analyzing music. And that's just that's a byproduct of what I've been doing with my life.
Yeah. That is so cool for you to say. I mean, that's everything about songwriting that I'm so about today, is when I hear songs and you know, there's something that when we were first starting out that was primitive and we didn't listen to music like that I sometimes wish I still had that innocence. But at the same time, like the minute I hear a song, I'm immediately dissecting it. How is this working? Why is the pre-chorus only once the first time, but it's twice the second time, you know, all that stuff that we analyze. It's so, to me, it's so cool.
Yeah, it is. But it's just a skill that you develop over all these years. And I don't think I'm missing out much by not naively enjoying stuff and not being interested into why it hits me a certain way.
Right.
I mean,
right.
I think my knowledge of how things are made contributes to my enjoyment.
Right on. Well, hey, gonna leave you with this. Lastly, here's your chance to let the listeners out there know what's going on with Brian Baker. This is time for your shameless plug. Go.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm never ashamed to pluck. There's no such thing as just at 55 years of age here in lovely New Jersey. I am doing a number of things. We've had a bit of a pause for live music performance. And when you're in the people gathering business, like me, that's kind of a big shakeup. And I'm trying to take advantage of that in some ways, but Bad Religion, would have been, well, still is celebrating our 40th anniversary this year. And there was a lot of touring and other cool stuff to go with it, which will have to be postponed. And then of course you have to, you can't use the t-shirts because it'd be the 41st year.
No one would buy them.
Who cares about the 41st year of anything? And I think by the time we actually get to play, maybe we shouldn't be talking about how cool we are and be more, maybe it should be the grateful tour rather than the, anyway, I could go on and on, but yeah, we're going to have to retool. But I mean, that's my thing. And that I just love being in this band. And that is my number one thing. I also have a new band called Fake Names. And we just had a record come out on Epitaph. It's a self-titled debut LP. And this is a band that I am in with Dennis Lixon from Refused and two old friends of mine from DC who are also in just fantastic bands. Michael Hampton plays guitar and he was in SOA, The Faith, and Embrace. And any fan of DC hardcore will immediately know who he is and the contribution that he made to our music there. And the bass player is Johnny Temple, who is in Soulside, was a DC band, like more of a mid-80s, 86, 87 band that was very, very important. And also in Girls Against Boys.
Wow.
Just another cool, like more of a major label kind of cool esoteric thing. And these guys basically... I just started writing music with Michael Hampton because when I moved up to New Jersey, Michael lives in Brooklyn and he's a composer. And so he works from home and he's very good at writing music because that's what he's been doing for 20 years. And because I'm so close that I can just go up there and have lunch, we just started playing guitar again. I mean, this is a guy I've known since I was literally in first grade.
Wow. So that's great.
You know, out of this rekindling of our friendship due to proximity, we wound up writing music, and the next thing you know, we're trying to put a band together, and we get next thing you know, you got a Swedish rock star singing for you, which is, I guess, this is what you get with experience. Like, when we went, let's just throw a little band together, and, you know, the pool that we're drawing from, I have to say, is probably a little different than the pool that some kids might be drawing from right now in, you know, Charlotte, North Carolina, at their community college. I say that this is the advantage experience that it's like, we found our singer because I knew Dennis from around, and Johnny and I were playing Riot Fest in Chicago, and he was playing in Girls Against Boys. I was playing in Bad Religion and Beach Rats on the same day. Double dip, the classic Greg Henson double dip.
Yeah, the old move.
Yeah, oh, it's a good one too. And Refuse were playing, and ran into Dennis in catering. I was like, Dennis, Johnny and I have this new band. It sounds kind of like, you know, Slow Dag Nasty in DC. Do you want to be in it? And he's like, send me the tapes. And I sent him some tapes. He's like, I would like to be in the band. And that's how that happened. I mean, another, you know, classic no expectation. Like,
yeah, but how fun is that to reconnect with your buddies, and there's no egos, and it's just about the love of music and fun. That's beautiful.
Right. And that is my kind of grown-up music side project. And surprisingly, people really seem to like it. I mean, I was even shocked that Brett wanted to put it out. We made our own demo, and I played it for Brett because I wanted him to ask him if he might know some like cool indie labels, like some small label, maybe in like Saskatchewan or Fort Myers, that might want to do a 7-inch with us or something. Like, honestly. And he's like, no, this is great. I want to put it out. And I'm like, you don't have to say that. It's cool. Like, I know we're in Bad Religion. I know, but come on. It's not a given.
Well, you know, I did not know you had this going. I missed that. I'm definitely going to check it out. I'm looking forward to that.
oh, you'll love it. It's great. And he really dug it. And so he put it out. And now people are really enjoying it. And then the less grown-up band I'm doing is Beach Rats, which is my local punk band. And that is that's just something I think everybody has to have. You have to have that local, you know, ride around on beach cruisers, and the people who drink have, you know, tall boys in paper bags, and you're kind of cruising around the boardwalk, and then you cruise up and go to practice and maybe jam for a while and then go get pizza.
Yeah.
But everybody's 50. It's awesome. I mean, again, no expectations, but the point of that band is the interaction with it's playing with friends, and same with all of these. You know, I've been so fortunate, and that every band that I'm in now is playing with friends. I mean, I'm still in Dag Nasty.
Yeah.
I play in Dag Nasty with Roger and Colin and Sean, the original three dudes who I started the band with. And it's like time travel playing with those guys. It's, you know, just it puts me right back into being 20 years old, and we have the same arguments and the same idiosyncrasies, and we make fun of each other the exact same way. We bring up shit that someone did to somebody else 35 years ago and rub it in their face.
Yeah. Yeah.
The gas station. It's like, it's perfect. So that's what this has all turned out to be, is just me hanging out with different friends and playing, you know, slightly different variations of a bar chord with the last two strings ringing at the end.
Yeah. It's amazing that, the only thing that's passed is the calendar. You know, everything else kind of stays the same, which is cool. All those little inside jokes still get under people's skin. I can relate.
So great.
Well, listen, Brian, I'm going to let you go. Man, thank you so much for giving me your time. And, you know, I'll be in touch. I love you, man. Appreciate it.
I love you too, Chris. I can't wait to see you in person when we can get back and get back to playing music with people around us.
Yes, I miss that more than ever right now.
That's why. I'm sure everybody does.
Yep. All right, bud. Have a great rest of your afternoon.
All right, cool. You too. I'll see you later.
Yeah, thanks.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
As we near the end of the show, here's a band you might not know.
Welcome to this week's Band You Might Not Know, where each week I will preview a select band of my choice, tell you a little bit about the band, where they're from, where to find their music, and how to find them on social media. It's simple, really. If you'd like your band to be previewed on Krista Makes a Podcast, all you have to do is submit your song and bio to bandyoumightnotknow@gmail.com. All I ask for is a good quality recording of a song you feel best represents your band. This week's featured band is Cassettes from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I love these guys. I love their sound. Totally 80s. Of course, Cassettes were popular in the 80s, so the name fits the band perfectly. I love their sound. On guitar and vocals, we got Matt DiStefano. On guitar, Jim Fox. Chris Hill on keys and vocals. Joe Robinson on bass. And Sean Ward on drums. You can find their music on Bandcamp, and you can find them online on Instagram at Cassettes Forever. Here's a snippet of their song, I Wanna Know.
I wanna know what your favorite drink is. I wanna know what my nephew's thinking. I wanna know what you deal. I wanna know how to feel. I wanna know. I wanna meet and fall in love with my best friend. I never wanna have to summer like it's ever again. I wanna know all your jokes. I wanna know every note. I wanna know, wanna know. But I just can't seem to breathe as deeply as I need. And I just can't.
The Wrap with Chris and Chris.
So that was pretty awesome to have such a punk rock pioneer as Brian Baker on this episode, man.
Yeah, I have to agree. I was not going to lie, I was starstruck when I first met Brian. Geez, it would have been back on the Warp Tour back in the 90s. And I'm, you know, just knowing Brian now, I just remember the look on his face, like, get away from me, kid, you know, because I was just fawning over him. But he's a legend, man.
Yeah. I mean, that's pretty funny when you meet those people that are from the generation before of what you do. You know, when you meet your peers all the time, but the people that are from the generation before, that's always kind of wild and intimidating. And but, you know, Brian seems really friendly and nice. Like, I feel like talk to that guy for 1 minute, maybe you won't be so intimidated.
No, he is. He's just, he's very, and it didn't really come off too much in the episode, but he's one of the most sarcastic people I've ever met. And I mean that in a great way. He's just really snide and but in a funny way. And he likes to bitch and complain, and he's awesome. He's a lot of fun. Every time we get together, Les and Jake did a tour of Bad Religion last year, and you know, it's you may not have seen Brian for a year or 2 years, but you pick, he's one of those guys you just pick right back up where you left off. You know, what you get is what you get with him.
That's cool, man. And, you know, something you guys talked about on this episode is the fact that when Brian was doing that thing we do and touring and things like that, especially back in the Minor Threat days, that was still like touring in a punk rock band was still a relatively new thing, and it was maybe considered a dangerous thing, or you know, it wasn't like what you and I have experienced of, yeah, you have this circuit of clubs that you play, and it's a well-worn path of, you know, the way to work your way up. It was kind of like they were in the Wild West of what they were doing.
You took the words out of my mouth. It was the Wild West. It's exactly what it was. It was I mean, you know, bands, and we've touched on this in the episode with Rick Nielsen, you know, bands back in the 70s up into the early 80s, they were out, you know, they're essentially cover bands. You'd get booked into a venue, you'd do 3, 4, 5 sets a night, and you know, lather, rinse, repeat. That was the thing. And these punk rockers were going out playing original music in a lot of times non-traditional venues. You know, they'd show up at a VFW hall, and you know, the police would be driving by and seeing these people with mohawks, like, ooh, these people are dangerous, you know. Right. And there was skinheads, there was all kinds of things that were going on. It was basically the misfits of society that were hanging out at a lot of these shows. And, you know, without Brian and Minor Threat and even some of the bands that preceded them, Ramon, Sex Pistols, etc., there's no way that a band like Less Than Jake would have had the opportunity to do what we do.
Right. And I think one thing that's really cool seems to be the thing in common with most things that Brian Baker is involved in is, when it comes to the songwriting, is socially conscious lyrics. And I think that's really cool. I know your band and my band, we've both, you know, have that element to some of our music, but we also have the love songs, and we also have the personal songs. But the lyrics of bands like Minor Threat and Dag Nasty and Bad Religion, like, oh my, like that is music that is trying to, in its own way, change the world, and has, you know, and that is such a cool thing.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and I had made a point that no one sounded like Dag Nasty in 1986. Right. mean, here they were. I mean, Minor Threat was, you know, still pretty rough around the edges. They were really punk rock, and you know, the lyrical content was a lot of the same themes in Dag Nasty, but there was a pop sensibility to it. Dag Nasty's recordings were really clean for that time. You know, punk rock was really dirty and raw and sloppy, and Dag Nasty was kind of the opposite of that, but yet there was still this unbridled energy and angst to it that came through. But you know, when I heard them around that time, 86, 87, again, I had never heard anything like it. You know, I was a pretty sheltered kid living in nowhere, Florida, and it was commercial radio and MTV, and they were not playing Dag Nasty, I could tell you that.
Yeah, man, 1986, yeah, it wasn't Dag Nasty. It was Motley Crue and Janet Jackson and Huey Lewis and the News. And not that I don't love all that, but yeah, there wasn't a lot of Dag Nasty on MTV and the radio. But hey, maybe that's a good thing, man.
Yeah, you know, it definitely was so different from everything to this small town kid from Florida that it really stuck out and resonated with me. And, you know, again, I was just... I know you were too. Super stoked to have Brian on the podcast, and it was another great episode, man.
Hell yeah, it was.
So, you know, I want to give a special shout out to all the listeners out there. Thank you for continuing to support not just my endeavors outside of the podcast and Less Than Jake, but Chris Fafalios, our wonderful producer here as well. You guys.
Thank you, guys.
Yes. Thank you very much. You know, we as musicians are always looking for ways to stay busy. And obviously touring is a huge part of a band like Less Than Jake. But, you know, aside from myself, the guys in my band have been staying busy as well. I'd like to give a big shout out right now to Mr. Roger Lima, the bass player for Less Than Jake. Roger has a studio called Mode House Recording Studio down in Gainesville, Florida. And it's where Less Than Jake recorded a ton of our projects over the years. Our See the Light record in 2013, our EP Sound the Alarm in 2017, and our most recent record that is coming out soon, Silver Linings, was tracked there. Roger's available for mastering, mixing, tracking, producing, editing, all the above and then some. You can email him directly. Go to rehasher.com. That's rehasher.com, rehasher.com. Or you can find him on Facebook at Mode House Recording Studio. Roger would like to hear from you, and he'll take good care of you. So wanted to give a shout out to my bro. We're all trying to navigate these waters while we're not on tour, Chris.
Yeah, man, dude, Roger's a beast too. That last tour that Punchline did with Less Than Jake, when he first let us hear that new Suicide Machines album, we were like, whoa.
Yeah, he did the latest Suicide Machines record, Revolution Spring, and that thing came out awesome.
Dude, yeah. If you're on the fence about going with Roger, go listen to Revolution Spring and you will be convinced.
Give him some love.
Hell yeah. Yeah, and also I want to thank everybody who listened, who contributed on ChristaMakesADifference.com. We now have a monthly cause that we like to get behind. And our very first one was Big Brothers and Big Sisters of the Laurel Region. That's near me. I asked Chris if that could be our first one, and he was all about it. And we set a goal of $1,000. We didn't know what to expect, and you guys already surpassed that. But let's keep it going. We got a couple more weeks to go. If you guys enjoy the podcast, it's a free podcast. We don't charge anything for this podcast. All we ask is that if you can, chip in a buck or two or $3. You know, the cost of a Dr. Pepper, if you add that up among thousands of people that subscribe to our podcast, that can add up and help a lot of kids. So I think that's really cool. Just go to ChrisDemakesADifference.com.
Right on. Thanks to each and every one of you for your generosity, and we will see you next week.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
Ever wonder what a punch from Elton John feels like?
Or how you cope with having turned down the chance to be in Nirvana?
Or what signal Keith Richards gives when he wants you to get the hell out of his hotel room?
Fans of Too Much Effing Perspective don't have to wonder, because they've heard these exact stories and a jillion others on our podcast. I'm Alex Hoffman, former tour manager for Radiohead.
And I'm musician and comedy writer Alan Keller. On the TMEP show, we get guests like Nancy Wilson from Heart, Jeremiah Freites from the Lumineers, and Modern Family's Julie Bowen to tell us things they may have only shared with their therapist, clergy, or a TMZ stringer.
So join us on Too Much Effing Perspective. That's EFFING Perspective, the only podcast you crank up to 11.